Intermittent Federal, I'm actually a safety officer, Maryland 1's disaster medical assistance team, as well as the national medical response team, all underneath ASPR and HHS. Firefighter EMT in Fairfax County, as well as a community representative at the Alexandria City, City of Alexandria's EMS Council. So I do a lot with preparedness and response. I've done a lot with public health in the last several years in Florida, Georgia, and Virginia, and specifically in the National Capital Region with different types of planning, pandemic influenza, smallpox, anthrax, a lot with Fairfax County, Alexandria, D.C., and so forth. So I'm coming from a different perspective. I'm not a disaster behavioral health specialist. I'm a responder who goes out into the field. We do deploy domestically and internationally, and as well as locally. When I'm not deployed with HHS, I will stand up over at Fairfax County and either be on an engine or a truck and be active in my local community. So different perspective, and so bear with me if my disaster behavioral health lingo is a little bit different from others. I do not have any disclosures today, and also want to throw that in there. I'm not speaking on behalf of the City of Alexandria or Fairfax County or HHS. My perspectives and what I'm going to be offering you all here today is going to be based on my experiences as a responder in the field, as well as a consultant with the federal government, local and states. Disaster behavioral health. I always like, you're at a public health conference, and a lot of you who are involved with preparedness and response are very familiar with PPHR. So I wanted to throw up here just a kind of a comparison between the HHS definition of disaster behavioral health as well as PPHR. You can see the similarities. I'm not going to go through and read this. You're all very familiar, I'm certain, with what these might be. But one of the kind of the standing points here is that we don't always have the same definitions of these terms, and that can be sometimes a conflict. But as you can see, the idea is building resilience, building sustainability. HHS focuses very heavily on, as they mentioned, the mental health side of the house, as well as the substance abuse, which are very, very important areas that we need to focus on. So just one of the different definitions that we have. One of the common challenges with behavioral health is that it's not always recognized as a core public health practice. You know, epidemiology, environmental health, all these historic legacy public health practices are just inherent. They're something that we do every day. Behavioral health, though, the irony is that it applies to absolutely everybody. So there's no one person that can escape not being affected by, in one way, shape, or form, by disaster. We have survivors of the affected community. We have survivors of the neighboring community who may rely on that community's resource, who may compete in athletics with that other organization, who may have shared experiences with that next community, who will feel their empathy or sympathize for those who have been affected. But then also across the entire United States, we have 9/11 is a great example, attacks, you know, in New York, and then also in Arlington, Virginia. But folks in Texas and California and were affected by it, as well as internationally. I went to Italy shortly after 9/11, and it was actually surprising how much it really impacted Italians as well. And it was a little bit ironic. They're like, well, I didn't know you all really cared about us like that much. But they were very stressed out, and it was very impacting to them. But also responders. I'm going to hit very heavy on responders later in my presentation, because I think it's a special population that we need to focus on when looking at disaster response and integrating everyone, as well as providers. Providers are also very important. I'm going to take a little bit of a twist here. And the reason I put this in here, the perfect plan, is when Rachel was going to describe her CONOPS, it's a federal plan. So what I'm going to do is throw out there, public health, we have our planning that we do with public health. We have emergency management. We've got disaster behavioral health. But really what we're trying to move forward with FEMA and how Craig Fugate talks about the whole community is fusing those together. And there's a lot of documents that we get that help us integrate this. In fact, emergency management, disaster response, when you start going into and doing research, you start seeing NEMS and the National Disaster Recovery Framework and the National Response Framework. You see different documents like the Integrated Planning System at the federal level. In fact, we've got mobile solutions now that we have through Apple when you're looking at PFA. HCEP, which is the Homeland Security Exercise Evaluation Program. We have all of these documents, a tremendous amount of knowledge. And the true integration is knowing what to use, how to use it, and when to use it. One of the big gaps that we see is behavioral health is definitely wanting to integrate with public health, and they're wanting to become, you know, part of that response, that just the routine and the day-to-day response of disasters, that they are going to be at the table, and just it's known, just like fire rescue or EMS. But in order for them to do that, they need to be very familiar with these policies, these programs, these documents. Same thing for public health. Those of you who may be in public health preparedness, it's very difficult to go to an emergency operations center and staff that if you're not familiar with ICS, if you're not familiar with NIMS, if you're not familiar with Presidential Policy Directive 8 for national preparedness, because they speak different languages. It's a foreign type of practice. So in order to truly integrate disaster behavioral health into public health, we have to speak the same language with preparedness and response as those who are doing emergency management do. And I come back to NIMS because more often than not, folks think, oh, well, NIMS is a class I took back in 2006. It was, you know, I had to deal with ICS 100. It was, you know, part of, you know, NIMS compliance for funding. But it's something we use every day. We can use it for planning a wedding. We can use it for managing a large-scale disaster. And it crosses into the federal government as well as local and state. So becoming familiar with this, and honestly, I really recommend go through this every year. Fire up your computer, take ICS 100 and 200 again, 700 and 800, all those courses that allow you to be familiar, because if we don't use this on a day-to-day basis, it becomes very foreign. It's very, very difficult to implement during an actual emergency and disaster. If you look at preparedness cycle, we talk about planning, organizing, training, exercising, and then improving those plans. So again, this process in NIMS should be this continuous cycle throughout a year, throughout every day, during disasters as well as not during disasters. So becoming, again, more familiar with the NIMS. Now, there was a different preparedness was defined, again, in the previous slide, as you know, you're exercising and evaluating. Well, PPD-8 goes a little bit further to talk about how organizing, equipping, and training, exercising to build sustainable capabilities. And I'll talk a little bit more about the capabilities specific to public health as part of PPD-8. But we're looking at five different mission areas. You've got the prevent, protect, mitigate, and respond. And these are new. This is a new document. It's back in 2011. And there are different frameworks coming out of this document that we'll get into a little bit more. But this is where our preparedness is moving, current administration. If the administration changes over, there may be some changes, but this is going to be where we are right now and moving forward. So we've got the national preparedness goal that came out of PPD-8. We have the national preparedness system. Underneath this, we've got several different frameworks, and I'll talk a little bit about those as well. But one of the key items, did the wrong key here, is what Craig Fugate really hits hard is this whole community. What does the whole community truly mean? Well, Presidential Policy Directive 8, PPD-8, again, these are the five different mission areas. It has different capabilities that you list underneath it. You don't have to be capable of all those different mission areas. You've got like drug interdiction, you've got communications, there's different things that apply. So whole communities, this applies to absolutely everybody. And what you'll see here is that when you take different mission areas, there are three capabilities that are cross-cutting. And there are three capabilities that we absolutely have to, in disaster behavioral response and public health, be very, very focused on. We need to be planning, constantly planning. We need to be constantly planning through prevention process, protection process, mitigation, response, and recovery. The other one is going to be operational coordination, making certain that we are coordinating with our partners. Again, this is not during disaster necessarily. It is before the disaster. It is after the disaster. It is constantly. And then also public information and warning. As we know, this is a huge public health opportunity with talking about risk communication and being able to prevent certain behaviors. Hey, don't go to that area because, hey, there's a hurricane there. You know, or you need to evacuate because you're in a floodplain. So different types of information given before the storm versus necessarily during or after. When you look at prevention, the NDR or the PPDA doesn't talk about anything health and medical specific. A lot of prevention factors are a lot of your counterterrorism areas. But again, we're still part of planning and operational coordination, so don't think that we're not part of prevention. We are part of prevention within public health. Same thing with protection. There's nothing really in the PPD-8 that talks about what public health should specifically do, but again, planning, again, operational coordination, and always is very important. Now, mitigation, it gets a little more specific. We look at community resilience. We look at a capability that talks about the risk disaster resilience assessment. These are ways that we can mitigate the health and medical impacts. Response, obviously, mass care services, public health and medical services, when we actually get into a response. And these capabilities, if you're familiar with the previous DHS target list capabilities, the TCLs, the target capability list, Those have been rescinded. So the target capabilities list that responders and emergency management, fire, rescue, public health were going after, saying, well, we need to have this capabilities, we need to have this toy to do that, we need radios, we need public health, you know, decontamination capabilities, all those are gone. This has been replaced by the PPDA, and there is a crosswalk between the TCLs and these capabilities. When you look at recovery, we look at, again, health and social services. Now, there's a lot more content that goes behind these capabilities, but these five mission areas and these capabilities are really where public health is stands out within PPDA. Again, within this sea of craziness, we have the HHS CONOPS that Rachel was going to be presenting on that we mentioned here a little bit ago. The difference between the HHS CONOPS and local and state planning, they're completely different types of beasts. You've got the federal plans follow what we call the integrated planning process. It was put together by the previous administration. It's supposed to be rescinded through PPDA, but there hasn't been any additional guidance that's been given for how the government will actually plan. So right now we're currently working on operating underneath the IPS. And it describes your strategic plan, your federal CONOPS, as well as operational plan. So this document for HHS is a conceptual plan. Okay, now for local and state, what I really recommend, and this is what we've used, throughout the different health departments and regions that we've coordinated and consulted with, is the CPG 101 version 2. The Comprehensive Planning Guide 101 version 2 talks about how to plan, how to prepare, how to integrate within your community. So it is something that that we definitely use right now. It replaced SLG 101. I'm not sure if any of you remember SLG 101. It was something used way back in the year. For several years it was used. It's this state and local guide for emergency planning. So the HHS CONOPS, again, is a federal concept plan. This is not something we take back to our local and states and actually just copy and paste. It's a reference. It's something this is how they're planning. The CPG 101 version 2 will actually give you guidance on how to create your own operational plans. This is huge for public health because you have guidance from PPHR that says this is what you have, these are your core capabilities, this is what you have to meet. That, in line with this, is critical. If you want to integrate with emergency management and other folks, you absolutely need to speak their same language. So using this and leveraging CPG 101 version 2 is critical. Again, this is emergency operational plans, but it also talks about SOPs, SOGs, as well as field operation guides. The key to this document is right here. It's the planning process. The planning process is where we build relationships. It's where we actually are able to effectively respond. It's not the plan that we write. The plan we write, it's a point of departure, so we should say. But the relationships you build with this planning process will enable you to respond very effectively. Next thing I'm going to talk about is practice integration. Again, we talk about the whole community. What does that whole community mean? It's bringing absolutely everybody together, and I would argue to say even survivors. It's the public. It is the media. It's, you know, Walmart. It's, you know, the telecommunications companies. It's absolutely everyone who has a place at the table during emergencies and disasters. Whereas public health is the lead for ESF8 and coordinating health and medical, that function, that capability is part of local and state health departments. But the rest of the community, ESF 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all of those together creates this whole entire community. So we get into some best practices. The National Capital Region, the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments has done tremendous work with regionalizing your plans. And they've actually integrated behavioral health, and so it's a great model. We're running short on time. So I recommend reaching out to MWCOG. They have tremendous data, and the folks out there are very willing to coordinate with other partners. Just tremendous lessons learned on how we deal with risk communication throughout the NCR, local, state, and federal level. So very, very excellent work that's been done there. One of the things as a responder I always like to tell folks is that It's a different beast. Responders are very, how do you put it? They provide a very unique challenge. They're the first on scene. They have the initial contact with the survivor. They are expected to conduct their day-to-day very difficult jobs while in the midst of this crazy disaster. They are subjected to continuous exposure because they're out there at the next operational period, they come back the next day, and they're continuing to be immersed into this disaster. And oftentimes, they're survivors themselves. And one of the big challenges is, as a police officer and as a firefighter, we don't really get much training in behavioral health. We talked a little bit about crisis intervention, a little bit about CISM or CISD stuff, but we really don't get into behavioral health. So I really recommend that, well, we need to do more with that. We need to be able to build in more capabilities. Dr. Christina Cablett, she's actually an ER physician at Johns Hopkins University, expert in disaster medicine, international medicine, wilderness medicine, VIP medicine. One of my good friends and colleagues, she's the medical officer for Maryland 1 DMAT. She's also the director for Johns Hopkins MRC. Tremendous international, domestic deployments. And the irony, she says, that psychological first aid is one of the most important skills that my team could have. She requires everyone on her team to take PFA. All medical physicians, all nurses, all paramedics, everyone has to take this. Again, she's a great physician, and she's practiced out of Baltimore and Johns Hopkins. Again, one of the challenges that we face is that responders haven't integrated behavioral health into the response curriculum or paradigm. Creating training programs is great. I think we need more of them. There's a lot out there that's very rich, but we don't currently have competencies that we actually can measure responders on, and we don't really have the requirements for skill demonstration. You know, you require paramedics and you require firefighters and responders to do CPR and to do ACLS and to do different types of life-saving techniques, and they have to demonstrate those techniques clinically. A step forward for disaster behavioral health would be able to integrate that type of practice, being able to teach responders how to the different skills that you need through PFA, but then also being able to walk them through and have them demonstrate these skills for you. Because we always say that perfect practice is not always the best thing. It's practice. Practice doesn't make perfect. It's perfect practice that makes perfect. And if we're not actually practicing these skills in during non-disaster times, it's very, very difficult to do it when the disaster occurs, especially for those who've not been trained. We talked about the learning from conferences, firsthand experiences versus fact sheets and other types of documents earlier, how effective they are. Really need to integrate more into the curriculum. But also, guidance for survivors, because there's nothing more empowering than to be on scene at a fire, to be deployed in a disaster, and to have a survivor say thank you. Thank you for your time, thank you for your effort, thank you for being here. Empowering the public to give back to responders and to make them feel like they really belong. This is kind of a fun little slide that talks about how when we deploy, we rotate call, we prepare, we train, we exercise, we get admission orders, we rapidly deploy, and a lot of times it's the unknown. Things happen, and we wait more, and we're all charged, and we're all excited. Then disaster hits, and we're just full speed. We're go. It's exhausting. It's exhausting for responders to go and to deploy into theater. And so with that, what I always tell my team is control the controllables. You only have control over yourself. You've got no control over the disaster. You've got no control over your travel. You've got no control over if you're going to shower the entire deployment. You don't know what you're going to eat. Control what you can, which is yourself and your perspective and your own behavior. I always say cura te ipsum, which is take care of oneself first, and then second, your patients, and then third, second, your team, and then third, your actual patients. And one of the most difficult, we'll get into another little slide about this in a second, but we just deployed actually last week. We had two FTXs the last two weekends with Maryland 1, New Jersey 1, and DC 1, and we talked a lot about team unity and support, and this is absolutely critical to mission success. There's always something new learned in disaster and training, absolutely something new, and that's something that you should go into disasters knowing that it's going to be very challenging, very difficult, but you're going to take back from that. One of our physicians talks about that, and he may be a physician in his day-to-day practice, but he's going to be a person that's going to be wiping behinds, he's going to be a pharmacist, he's going to be doing all kinds of other duties and jobs, a logistician. He's not going to be a physician the entire time when he's on deployment. He might need to be a person that's delivering behavioral health or public health practices. So that integration is absolutely critical. Knowing what to decide, one of the more difficult things is right here, knowing when to make decisions on when to deliver care and when not to. We have to make those when you have limited resources and you've got, you know, several thousands of patients, knowing when not to continue CPR, knowing not when not to, is probably more difficult than deciding when. And it's something that our physicians don't do on a day-to-day basis, and so it can be very, very stressful for our clinicians. Christina, she points out that she's personally hasn't saved a lot of lives in disasters. This is deployments, again, domestic, internationally, but she's given a lot of hugs and she's held a lot of hands, and that's what we do. So those of you who are physicians and nurses, when we deploy domestically, internationally to any type of disaster, we're actually doing more behavioral health, and we don't even know it, than we are actually delivering clinical care. And this is very ironic because we don't think about it. It's not very explicit that we're actually doing that, but it's very true. One thing I could throw out there, this is kind of a cute little slide I put together last minute, but integrating the whole community requires being able to create solutions for survivors to help survivors, for survivors to help responders, for survivors to help providers. Well, you're probably thinking, what does that mean? Well, isn't it the other way around? No, not really. You know, survivors can help one another, but we need to give them the tools to show them how. We need to be able to link them together. You know, we don't want to separate people and say, hey, you can't be exposed to this person because you're part of the disaster. Link them together. Let them talk about their stories. Let them share experiences. Responders helping survivors, firefighters, paramedics, nurses. We have tremendous opportunities during disasters to provide support to survivors. Responders helping responders, responders helping providers. So this paradigm is that we all should be helping everyone. We all should be helping one another. But I also like to go a little bit further and say animals. I don't know about you all, but I have a golden retriever at home. They are amazing, right? When I go on deployment, I usually try to find our VMAT or our veterinarian or national national veterinarian response teams, or I like to find our USAR teams, urban search and rescue teams, because you will find dogs there. And there's nothing cooler than when you've spent 12, 18 hours working to go over and just hug a golden retriever, hug a Labrador. It is empowering. It absolutely is. And it helps those dogs too, especially the working dogs, because they get exhausted. So, and then this is a little bit of a joke that's not really Asper, but kind of toy it around a little bit here. It's kind of like Asper. So this is kind of neat here. Health information technology and information exchange. This is a new, this is very new. There's the ability to integrate mobility and to integrate technology into the response is here. I did a piloted program with HHS back during Katrina with the Census Bureau, and we had this Palm PDA that had like this huge case on it. It looked like a spacecraft that I was holding in my hands that we were doing population estimates down in Katrina. And it was so funny because it was basically a checklist in a form. It was very difficult. But we were thinking then, man, one day we will have mobility in our hands. Well, the time is now. But the time is even actually more advanced. Not only do we have mobility, but now we have the opportunity to integrate information and to share information. And there's been a lot of work that's just been done. This is for those of you who are interested in more about HIE and HIT, with being able to integrate it during disasters. And Southwestern Consortium put together a publication that's now available. You can see the reference here. So this is an HIEA example. It's extremely complex that integrates all information. Again, I encourage you to take this and to download it, the slides, and you'll be able to see more about that. But it's an extremely complex program. So that's pretty much it. So thank you all for your time. So.
Thanks, Richard. As you can see, we have a lot of information to share, and certainly hope that you access what we have given to you. And we have a couple of minutes for questions. Basically, our message to sum it up is for you as public health folks to think, as a planner, who are your partners that you want to be working with? But also, from our perspective, what do you need from us? Because it's not just what we do, it's how we can support you, and it's what we don't do, in a sense, but instead have that presence and give you what you need so that you can do the work that you need to for your communities. Questions?
To the NWCOG that I referred to before, I didn't get to touch on it in my presentation, I apologize, but we wrote a framework for the National Capital Region that fully discusses the USPHS, and she's exactly right. It's a tremendous asset, tremendous resource that we use throughout disasters domestically and internationally, and very, very powerful capability.
I'm
I apologize. As you can see, we were trying to put a tremendous amount of information into this, and I think Rachel Cole's presentation would have specifically addressed some of the other organizations and entities within the federal government. It really was, she was the one who was really talking about that. As I said, I apologize. I was not as well equipped to address that, but thank you for bringing it up. Thank you.
Because of the disaster that's going on right now, at Samhsa we have two of our public health officers, commission corps officers, that have been deployed, actually yesterday or Monday, to those disasters. So, yes, we're heavily involved.
Yes, thank you to Captain Robinson. And many of our public health representatives are Samhsa folks. Thank you. There's another question.
Just a question for Firefighter Burrow. I'm a former member of EMAC-CA 6. I was one of the early, I was recruited early from the community for my skills as part of rock medicine, part of the Haight-Ashbury Preclinics, MASCAP events, acute psychiatric intervention, lots of minor surgery, general medicine. And what I saw happening between, say, 98, 99, and the mid-2000s, going through the under the aegis of USPHS, then to, I think it was FEMA, and then they realized it wasn't FEMA, so really it was HHS. USPHS really doesn't have much integration. What I've seen is that there's an entire change in the culture of DMAC, that it is perhaps, tell me whether this is a regional thing or whether it's a national thing, but it's become, you know, heavily integrated with veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. It's moved away from actually members of the community, general community. It's tanking maybe because of the command structure. It's become much more sort of militaristic. And the basic question has to do with an issue that came up at Katrina Rita, which was that there was a lack of cultural competency. Not just not quite speaking in the same dialect, but not having the same basis and background, and not realizing that a lot of people who live marginally have absolutely no interest in getting involved with firefighters, police, anybody in uniform, and I think that also happened to a certain degree in Haiti. So the question is the culture of DMAT moving further away from being able to really being a part of the community and identify with the community?
Well, I've been on three DMATs. I've been on Florida 3, Georgia 3, and now Maryland 1. I was there at the beginning, the inception of Maryland 1. And one of the core fundamental attributes of DMATs is they come from the local community. You know, we have a proximity that we have to live within a certain radius of teams. It's sort of a new, in the last couple of years, they've been really trying to push that you are from your local community. So DMATs are local providers. They can't be federal providers. They are clinicians from your community. We do a lot with training, a tremendous amount of with training with USPHS. The culture is dependent on the community that they come from. You know, it's very heterogeneous because it's from all over the United States. We've got over 50 plus teams that are now post Katrina. And you know, I wouldn't say that there's any one culture that there's one specific culture. I would say that there's many cultures. When we deploy and put different DMATs together, it's like having different families. We do a lot with integrating them. In fact, we used to just deploy teams and they'd be sitting next to one another and we would do our own thing. Now we mix them. We mix and match. And we, with using NEMS and using ICS, we make that as heterogeneous as possible. I wouldn't say that the culture is moving away to be less productive. It's being enhanced. Haiti, we have a tremendous amount of lessons learned. Some physicians that deploy to Haiti have been to Haiti years prior. Christine is a great example. Christine had been to Haiti several times in missions, and that mission was extremely disturbing for her because she saw all the work that she had done, just being, you know, just and all the people that she had helped for years prior. Not every person deploys. We have physicians who never deployed before, and so the first time in theater, it's going to be a different experience for them. So DMATs are heterogeneous mixtures of people who are seasoned, people who are new, people who do emergency medicine, family medicine. The culture, I wouldn't say is homogenous by any means, or to what you're explaining, militaristic. We're very civilian, even though we're in uniforms. We're very civilian-like, very community-like. That's, again, the experience I have. Some teams may be different. You're always going to have subcultures. Right. You're always going to have subcultures. You're always going to have individuals who are, you know, but for the most part, they're very heterogeneous, and we have a tremendous amount of people that we have on those teams.
Another question.
My question is sort of feeding into this question. You talked about the need for disaster field personnel having certain competencies to be able to effectively respond in the field and meet the needs of the community. What disaster behavioral competencies do you think they need in order to display that?
Well, I would lean towards April with you talking about some of the curriculum and some of the trainings that are available. PFA being one of the most important right now. We have a history of using CISM and CISD, which is not shown to be as effective with responders. So moving more towards what evidence-based and what the research is showing to be productive is PFA. The catch to that and the turnaround of that is doing what we don't currently have in place is creating, you know, actual abilities to demonstrate those skills. Demonstrate those skills in exercises and demonstrate those skills in day-to-day trainings and in part of your certification. That would be what I would recommend because we don't do that right now. Mm-hmm. And that's it's different from PFA on a piece of paper versus PFA in a classroom actually doing it are totally different.
And then when there is a federally declared disaster, the Crisis Counseling and Assistance Program, the FEMA-funded program, does have specific mandatory trainings for all the community members who come in to be crisis counseling responders. The crisis counseling, the core training, anniversary training, mid-training, cultural competence, stress management, we have a list of those required trainings. Red Cross also has quite a few very good mental health, which is also now based on psychological first aid. I just want to reiterate, psychological first aid is meant to be an immediate response, 14 to 30 days. After that, we move into the crisis counseling program. And so we offer those.
Yeah. Right. So how do we add public health practitioners imposed upon personnel or field staff, like you would say, these are mm-hmm. skills that you need?
The best way to integrate with law enforcement, fire rescue, is to be at the table with them. You need to be a part of their planning. When they're doing planning for shelters, they're doing planning for response, for hurricanes, you need to be at the table. Mm-hmm. And just continue to show that you're a resource. They will eventually reach out. It takes time. It just takes time. Be familiar with their language. You know, it's. I would even say dress like they dress when you go to disasters. Don't wear a suit when you go to a shelter. Wear their tactical clothing. Because that's how their culture is. You know, be like, and so, and just be continuously engaging. And that brings back to the whole community and the collaborative planning process.
Yeah, for sure. It's certainly that being at the table with them. But everyone is really expected to at least have taken the PFA in disaster response. I think the whole public health sector is getting the message that, at a minimum, that compassionate presence, safety, calming, and the ability to link people with family and other supports and resources is a mandatory for every disaster responder. So it's a good place to start. Thank you. We know that it's been tough getting around the city today, so we appreciate your presence and your attention.